is University Forum. I'm Gene Moore, bringing you conversations with outstanding personalities on issues of interest to local, national, and international communities. Our topic today, social medicine and community health. My guest is Dr. Walter J. Lehrer, a medical doctor who is president of the Institute of Social Medicine and Community Health in Philadelphia, and acting director of the Institute's History Center. Welcome to University Forum, Dr. Lehrer.
Delighted to be here.
Well, Walter, we go back to such an exciting time back in the 60s when we last met. You were then, I think, first deputy health commissioner of the Philadelphia Health Department, and I was the social work specialist in the relocation operations of the Philadelphia Redevelopment Authority. You remember those days?
That was great.
Yeah. I remember us sitting on the floor one time in your office trying to do a grant proposal. Cutting and pasting. No computers then. And we were cutting and pasting trying to get this grant in, and we got it in. Mm-hmm. And it was funded. You remember what it was for?
No.
I know you don't even remember anything about it, but I do, because it was for providing health care to people who were being dislocated and then relocated because of governmental action.
Oh, right.
And we were going to try to have the health care to follow them, and it was funded.
Thank you.
Yeah, but I left and I went to HUD, and so it was never implemented, I understand. But I tell you, I think about that, and I think about so many things that you were doing and have continued to do. I've been following your career over the years. But what's happening? What are the key issues that you see in healthcare today? And how does this compare with what was going on back in the 60s, those turbulent 60s?
I really think that the issue that's major, which is being ignored, is the issue of the impact of poverty on health of a huge part of the population. The lack of basic income so that people can have a decent place to live, can have decent meals, can get proper education, and obviously can't get decent health care. It is devastating to a huge number of people in the United States, and the issue is largely swept under the rug.
When you say that, and we think that it's now how many years from the time of the 60s when it was considered a time when the rebellion, if you will, was based on all the things that were not happening in certain communities, it doesn't sound like that much has changed.
Poverty has been with us, that is, in the United States, from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yes, poverty was a big issue in the 60s, but it was a big issue in the 19th century and the early 20th century. And lots of discussion, rhetoric, proposals. And today, 2006, we still have an increasing number of people, families, and children living in poverty.
In the 60s, to do a little bit of historical search, because we may go back to those other centuries to think a little bit about those, but when there was an identification that all these things existed, that poverty was there, are the root causes of poor health care based on poverty? Is that one of the basic root causes of it?
In my opinion, yes.
Mm-hmm.
It's poverty that limits the opportunities of people to live full and healthy lives.
Well, what happened now? Back in the 60s, because I need to hearken back, because that's really the last time that we saw each other on that. But in the 60s, there were all these programs, one of which was Model Cities. And I think you were very active in the Model Cities time in the communities in Philadelphia.
We tried very hard to do a meaningful health package in the Model Cities program. And we set up an office right around the corner here where we had the city health department staff that was working on this together with the staff people from the citizens group. And the staff person then was Maddie Humphrey, who you may remember.
Yes, I remember Maddie.
And we worked together in the same office, and we came up with a citizen-controlled health insurance plan, which was part of the overall citizen-controlled model cities program, which when it was completed and submitted to the mayor, he threw it out entirely.
Who was the mayor? Oh, do tell me who was the mayor. I think I know who it was.
Anyway.
You don't want to say who's the mayor? You can say. I know who the mayor was back when they had the strike with the students marching up and down the streets. It's the same mayor.
Yeah. And so then an entirely new model cities plan was developed, which was not citizen controlled, not as comprehensive as what Maddie Humphrey and my staff in the city health department had designed.
For those who do not know what model cities means, it was a special program that was developed to certain cities throughout the country with federal support and federal planning staff to help with the cities doing their own staff development and particularly concentrating on citizen participation. That was the mantra of the Model Cities program.
It was part of Johnson's war on poverty.
Yes, yes it was, yes. It really was a fascinating program. And some people say that it didn't work, but did it have a chance to work, really?
Well, here in Philadelphia, I don't think it was given a chance. Mm-hmm.
So one of the things, then, is that there is this gap that's existed over time between what citizens want and need and what sometimes doesn't happen.
Mm-hmm. From my bias perspective, the one positive result of that model cities planning effort was developing citizen groups and leaders that were concerned with health. And that continued after the model cities fiasco. And so we had citizen groups, particularly in North Central Philadelphia, that were focused on dealing with health problems.
I think you're so right, because I found that in other cities around the country, I covered some of the other states in this area, and it's what was happening to the people who were then being aroused in terms of knowing that they should and could make a difference. So I know Maddie Humphreys was a marvelous person in that field at the time.
Fantastic. Yeah, fabulous. Yeah.
So you were at that time, let's see now if I got it straight, because you had another position.
I was
position.
In the city health department, and I was the deputy health commissioner, and one of my responsibilities was health policy and planning.
Yeah.
And so the model cities planning effort was my responsibility.
And it's so hard to know that here was a joint effort between a governmental agency and from your offices, and it wasn't the kind of conflict we saw in some cities where maybe there wasn't anything happening at the local level there. And here you had that, but being really overruled by the administrative arm of the city itself. Now, when we look through and going on all the different things that you've done, let's talk a bit about that, because you've spent your life really working in all of these areas. When I first met you and we were working on those plans and all, and you continued to work even in different positions doing a lot of the similar things.
Well, after the city health department work, I then was appointed to the state health department, and I was able to create new kinds of programs that were very friendly to the issues of citizens and recipients of health care. And in fact, we set up the first and maybe the only complaint service about health care. The first and only one in a governmental health program. And we handled complaints of all kinds. I thought it was very successful.
Was that with the southeastern part of the state down here? And we're talking now out of the North Philadelphia area. And was this considered?
Yeah, I was the health commissioner for the southeastern region of the state of Pennsylvania. And I had good relationships with the governor at that time, who was Milton Schaap, and with his staff. And when I came up with this suggestion for a health consumer complaint service, they were very supportive.
Now, was this the time when the health and public welfare were together? What happened in that arrangement?
I convinced the governor's office that there was so much overlapping of interests in the state health department and the state public welfare department that they really should be administered jointly. And in fact, that issue had been dealt with for some decades prior to my joining the state government. And at one point, an individual who had some relationship to Temple was appointed Secretary of the Health Department and at the same time Secretary of the Public Welfare Department.
He was a physician, was he?
Yes.
Dr. Georges?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And it didn't work at that level. But at my level, I was able to, for example, have staff meetings where both the State Welfare Department people concerned with health and the State Health Department people in the region would meet together and talk together and work together. So from my point of view, for 3 or 4 years, we had a very functional and, I think, effective joint operation between the two state departments.
Well, it makes sense when you think of what you said in the beginning of our conversation was the relationship between the welfare needs, meaning really the public welfare, by whatever interpretation one wants to put on that, with their actual health. Mm-hmm. And if you can put some of those things at least to talk together on it, that's so important.
Well, it wasn't a matter of interpreting what the public welfare people were up to. It was what they were legally responsible for. They were legally responsible for the Medicaid program, for the entire mental health program. So actually, the State Welfare Department was responsible for the biggest health programs that the state government had was involved in. And so, you know, to me, it just didn't make sense that the state health department had no input and no relationship to the state welfare department. So we did that for, as I said, for a number of years.
What happened, do you know? How did it change? Or did it go the way of just change?
You can interpret it differently. The fact was that both the state health department and the state welfare department changed their structure by eliminating the regions of the state. So there was no longer any southeast region of the health department and no longer any southeast region of the welfare department.
Well, that's one way of rearranging.
Yes.
All kinds of things.
Right, right.
Mm-hmm.
So everything from in those state departments was more centralized in Harrisburg, yes.
You're listening to University Forum with my guest, Dr. Walter Lehr, the president of an organization, actually, that's called the Institute of Social Medicine and Community Health in Philadelphia. Walter Lehr, talk a little bit about some of the things that you moved into. What do you see as the problems that deal with certain kinds of specific groups? Like, is there a difference between being poor and black and being poor and white? Or is poverty level all groups? What are some of those kinds of issues?
I also strongly believe that racism has a major negative impact on people's health. And racism continues to be rampant and ubiquitous in this country and in Philadelphia, in my opinion. And all of the academic studies on the status of people's health show that African-American people come out much more poorly on the results of our high-tech medical care system than do other parts of the population.
You've been involved in ways of dealing with racism and other issues. Give me a story or two of what has happened to you.
Well, my first and most notorious activity regarding racism was organizing a public demonstration against the American Medical Association in 1963. This demonstration was held in Atlantic City on the boardwalk outside of the hotel where the American Medical Association was having its annual meeting. And there's one funny little aspect that might be appropriate to relate about the organizing of that demonstration. I had previously been in peace demonstrations, and I was aware of the awkwardness that I had in my first peace demonstrations in carrying a sign, because it was not part of the culture of physicians to not only participate in demonstrations, but to carry a sign. So we had decided that we would put our message about the AMA's racism on boards, on signs that would stand up on the boardwalk. But this presented a problem because there's an Atlantic City law that says nothing can be put on the boardwalk that is stationary. So we went to see the chief of police of Atlantic City a few days before the demonstration, and we explained to him that we had this message to get out about the racism of the American Medical Association, and that doctors couldn't carry the signs with this message, that we had to place these signs standing on the boardwalk. We said, doctors can't carry signs. And the chief of police, he looked at my co-chair, Mike Holloman, a African-American physician from New York City, and he looked at him, and then he looked at me, and then he said, yes, doctors can't carry signs.
Status.
And so we were allowed to have our signs standing on the boardwalk, and we marched around them. And the one photograph of that demonstration shows the signs and our marching around the signs on the boardwalk. And that appeared, for example, in the New York Times and in other newspapers and medical newspapers.
New York Times.
Yeah.
Doctors walking around. Not carrying the signs, though.
So it was a mixture of the decorum that was current fashion among physicians and the militancy of the students and the blacks at that time.
What actually happened as a result of that with the AMA? Did anything change then?
Yes. After several more years of harassing the American Medical Association, it finally agreed that it would prohibit the racial discrimination policies in the organization and its affiliates, which are the state and local medical societies. And so that was all eliminated. That is the legal, formal, organizational requirements that prohibited African-American physicians from being members of the American Medical Association and its state and local affiliates. That was eliminated.
I don't know that many people realize that there had been that prohibition.
Oh, it depends on your age. I think you and I have enough years behind us to know that not only existed, but for example, one of the clear indications of this kind of discrimination that existed in the United States, this other physician, Dr. Holloman, who was the co-chair of this effort, he told me that when he served in the Army at that time, he was an officer, as all physicians were, but he was not allowed in the officers' club because he was African-American.
That was true not only for those who may have been medical, but also for other officers who were black.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely so. As you pull together, then, this discrimination, the racism, and the impact on healthcare, what else did you see developing over time that you were involved with around those issues? Because I know that you were into all kinds of things. There were other groups besides the American Medical Association. And what is the other group, the American Public Health? You got into public health also, your master's, actually. Now, I know your undergraduate work was at Harvard, You're a Harvard person. Harvard. With your medical degree, Long Island University. But then
It's now called State University, downstate, yeah.
But then you did some work over there.
And then I got my public health degree at Columbia University in New York. Yes. Mm-hmm. But I considered myself a public health specialist. And actually, my real specialty was administration. And that's what I did after I finished my internship, was administer health services, whether governmental health services or hospitals or clinics or insurance, health insurance. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, and I did that for 30 years. And then when I concluded my work as a medical and public health administrator, then I became a medical historian. And so for 30 years now, I've been a medical historian. In my medical history work, I limit myself, it's not such a little limit, I limit myself to the political aspects of the health field of the United States from the 1870s to the present, with a main interest in the activists and politically liberal left activities in the health field of the United States. So, among other things, for example, I've followed closely all of the health activities in Philadelphia, which has had a very impressive, very strong kinds and scope of health activism, including women's health issues, workers' health issues, international health issues, as well as working and advocating a good national health plan, which has been part of an effort now over 100 years that this country has been talking about the need for a national health program, and people have been working for that unsuccessfully for over 100 years. So, yes, I've been involved in a lot of those activities for a national health program, and my history work also has a major piece on the struggles for national health insurance or national health service or a good national health program.
And we're going to have another program after we finish this one that our listeners can hear in our next University Forum program. But before we close down this part, talk a bit about getting back to some of the things that you did with around racism and those issues. You mentioned another organization, the American Public Health Association. Mm-hmm. One last story about the American Public Health Association. And was it open and accessible and fair to people of different races?
The American Public Health Association did have a very good political perspective dealing with the health issues of people, and in particular dealing with the issues of racism. And in fact, it had a major committee that dealt with equal health opportunities, which I was appointed to and served as chair of that committee for a number of years. And it also, for example, early on, took a very good stand on the issue of the federal program to fund the construction of hospitals, which was part of a program funded by the Hill-Burton bill. And when originally passed, since Senator Hill was from Alabama, it allowed segregated hospitals, the funds for building segregated hospitals. And so we worked in the American Public Health Association to oppose that provision, to have it deleted. And after a couple of years of work, the American Public Health Association took the position that that should be eliminated, even though there were a lot of folks in the health field who thought that that might torpedo the whole hospital construction aid program. But we said, no, funding segregated hospitals should not be done. And finally, the Congress was convinced of that, and the clause in the Hill-Burton law allowing segregated hospital was eliminated. So, yes, the American Public Health Association was very good on the issues of racism. Mm-hmm. And in fact, it continues to be very good on the issues of a national health program. It supports a single-payer national health program. And single-payer is really the fancy name for saying Medicare should be available to everybody in the United States.
We're going to continue our conversation for another University Forum program. We've just begun to touch the tip of all of this. But I want to thank you so much for being with me at this point and being my guest on University Forum, Dr. Walter Lehr.
And we thank you very much.
And we're going to continue for another show.
Look forward to it.
You're listening to University Forum. I'm Jean Moore. Please send your comments or questions on University Forum programs to me by email, jemoore@temple.edu, or call my voicemail, 215-204-4376. And don't forget to listen in next week.